Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, when you guys hear this, happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, indeed. We're recording a day early because I wanted to actually be able to celebrate a little bit with my wife.
That's fair, I guess.
Pumping
very important things like our podcast schedule for, you know, your marriage. I guess I'll slide.
Yeah, just this time. Usually it, sometimes the marriage takes a backseat to content, and I felt like this was one time it shouldn't. I'm married
probably,
to the
probably blog. Right. Yeah. When Syracuse is like 9-3 in the ACC, then we can, you know, start to move around our actual lives here.
That's true. So yeah, Dan, Syracuse has won two straight. That's pretty good. They made it horrifying this weekend, however. That was not good.
Yeah, we spent like, what, three quarters of the game being like, how do we lose to this Wake Forest team the first time?
And then
we
suddenly
spent the last like quarter of the game being like, oh,
yes.
Right.
This.
I remember.
It was funny, actually, because like, Jim Boeheim had that comment after where it was like, oh, like I'd never seen somebody go like 9 of 10 from 3, or was it like 6 straight or whatever? And like I wanted to point directly to the NC State game with John Gillen last year when he hit 9 of 10 threes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's – I assume Boeheim meant like against us, but like – there have certainly been games that feel that way, if not, like, exactly that. But that was nuts. I mean, it was nuts that it happened, and it was also nuts that Syracuse, like, didn't surrender the lead because they were just playing well enough offensively, which was nice. But, man, like, if we could not do that again, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'll take any opportunity to not do that ever again, just because there's no guarantee we're going to be able to hit those shots against better opponents. Obviously, Wake is not as terrible as their record indicates. And I'm honestly surprised they've been able to be like this bad from a win-loss perspective, because I don't really think they're much worse than last year. I mean, obviously, you know, you lose NBA quality talent, sure, but I still think there's a really good collection of players on that roster, which also kind of speaks to just how deep the ACC is, which, you know, you and I kind of talked about in preseason and has really lived itself out this year, albeit much differently than we probably expected.
Yeah, I actually thought, you know, sometimes Boeheim goes a little over the top and complimenting opponents who almost beat us or do beat us. I actually thought he was pretty spot on with the whole, like, Wake is a pretty good offensive team. I mean, Wilbekin and Crawford are a pretty good backcourt. I know Wilbekin didn't start this team, but, like, they have some talent. They're just, defensively, they're just not good. Like, they are a bad defensive team, as evidenced by the fact that we shot, you know, 46 from the field and 50% from three against them. That shouldn't be happening for anyone this year against us, as we are very offensively challenged. And I really loved on our end how mostly Battle, but also a little bit of Howard and Brissett, just decided to, like, cut the pretense and just go right at their defense every time. It wasn't like, you know, our assist numbers actually were up because Howard had 9. So we had 16 for the game, which is pretty good for us. But overall, like, this was one game where our, you know, kind of one-on-one, you know, take the ball to the hoop style of offense really benefited, because their guards did not stand in front of Tyus Battle at all, and he had probably his best overall offensive game of the season.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was efficient. I think he was able to be physical. He was able to go to the paint. I do think that, like, no, you're not always going to be able to play like we did against Wake. From a one-on-one perspective, obviously driving the lane perspective, you're not going to be able to do that against Virginia. But I did feel like against Virginia, we almost did play a little too far into their style of play. We really, I mean, sure, they were cutting things off defensively, but when you look back at that game, SU really wasn't trying to challenge them. And the times they did actually challenge them, they made it. Like, they were able to penetrate the defense. It's kind of tougher when you are so short-staffed in terms of, you know, available players, things like that. But overall, like, I think that the more SU can drive the lane, the more they can draw fouls. This isn't an amazing foul shooting team, and obviously you don't want to see, you know, stuff like Frank missing as many as he did late, but at the same time, like, I think driving the lane as much as you can, trying to draw some contact, and utilizing what is some pretty great cutting ability from Battle, those just seem like, you know, easy wins and ways to boost the lack of scoring output we've seen from SU this year.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the more impressive displays of actually, like, recognizing what was working and going to it and not letting up, like, compared to what we watched Louisville fail to do against us last week after, you know, that stretch where they couldn't stop scoring. Syracuse, like, the entire game just knew, take the ball to the basket, It'll open up some threes, and obviously, we've talked about a number of threes we'd like to see this team shoot. If we're taking 12, we're hitting sits, like, that is right in our wheelhouse. We should not be taking that many more than, like, the 12 to 15 range. And if we're hitting between 40 and 50%, I think we're going to be in most of those games. So overall, offensively, I don't have a lot to complain about. The one thing I complain about, Frank Howard needs to hit his free throws, 4 for 10. And some of those, I think we, as a team, missed 5 in a row down the stretch at one point.
Yeah.
Which obviously wasn't, like, the only problem, since Wake literally wouldn't stop hitting threes. But probably would have made this a little less dramatic down the stretch. But aside from that, offensively, a lot to be happy about. Defensively, like, it's easy to get on the defense. But Wake was hitting shots that were, like, contested. Wake was just drilling shots, and, like, you can only do so much. Like, sometimes the ball's in a fall.
It was the same shit that, like, I've talked about, like, against Virginia and against, like, Louisville and some other opponents. Like, you know what? Like, you have to kind of pick your battles. Like, I'm not, to be honest, like, I the contested stuff, like, if they're contested threes, like, you did your job. They're just, it was meant to be. But I think, like, you look at this game a little bit differently than, like, again, like, those Virginia game or the Louisville game. Like, if you're going to hit from the parking lot, like, I still don't endorse trying to spread this zone out 5 feet past the three-point line. Like, if you're going to hit those shots, they're not going to fall forever. Like, unless you're Steph Curry, they're not going to fall, like, for a full game. So, you know, why bother overextending your defense? I'll let them take that shot every time, because there's very few players that are going to be able to hit it consistently. Wake might have been a team that was able to hit it consistently, over the weekend, but, you know, more often than not, especially at the college level, like, you're just not going to see that amount of efficiency from, like, super deep. So I'm not as worried about the overall 3-point defense after that showing than some others might have been. And I know Boeheim seemed to be in game.
Yeah, and again, you have to, I think you take these things in terms of, like, what they look like from a long stretch, and we know this defense has been good all year. That doesn't mean that it's not going to have moments where it's scary and teams are hitting shots. That's kind of the thing with Syracuse zone. But overall, I think you take what you get with it. And the offense, like, it's nice that we've scored 78 points in two straight games. I'm not ready to, like, get off of the worry wagon in terms of the offense. But, you know, hopefully this trend upwards continues. Overall, I feel very happy that we won these two games. I think we really needed to. But I think the general consensus of what this team is kind of remains through these two games. It's just that we're still, like, kind of in the hunt here.
Yeah, I completely agree there. And I think that's a good segue for what I wanted to talk about next. If you were a Syracuse fan that's on Twitter, you might have noticed on Tuesday, you woke up to the pleasant sight of seeing Mike Waters drag some really lazy opinions about Syracuse, in particular from one Brad Evans from Yahoo. But in general, like, just a really nice job of, like, not being a dick about it and just spelling out facts. And I know Brad seemed to, his refrain to everyone seemed to be facts are facts. But Mike kept meeting him with better facts and ones that refuted his definitely lazy kind of 10 years outdated points about Syracuse basketball.
Who knew that Brad Evans did stuff that wasn't fantasy football?
He might never again.
I literally didn't know that. I looked, I'm like, wait, is that the fantasy football guy? And I only know him because if you, like, play fantasy football on Yahoo, his, like, little videos pop up every so often. I've never actually, like, engaged with his content in any meaningful way before, and I don't think I will be going forward because, man, that was, like, some really C-list, C-grade, like, you know, Syracuse doesn't schedule anyone nonsense from, like, 2010.
Yeah, like, even Gottlieb doesn't try that shit anymore.
Yeah, A, it's not our fault that UConn and Georgetown are total hot garbage this year. And B, like, our state of the schedule's fine. We actually have some pretty quality, yeah, mid-major opponents. Buffalo and St. Bonaventure, both very solid mid-major opponents. So just, yeah, a weird, like, I'm not surprised that people are doing it. I'm surprised that someone who is trying to, like, analyze something is doing it at this point. I don't know if I should be, but it was just strange to hear that. When Syracuse, my favorite part was, like, if you looked in the replies, Syracuse fans weren't be like, no, we're definitely a tournament team. We're like, we might not be a tournament team, but this is not why. Like, if we're not a tournament team, it's because we're not very good. And not that our strength of schedule is weak. Like, what, if we had scheduled, a couple more SEC teams, we'd be any better? No, we'd probably have another loss, and we'd be in the same spot.
Exactly. Like, it's just a quick And that, I think that's always been why Syracuse fans are always so quick on the trigger, because it's rarely, you don't see the same people responding to the criticisms by those who have, like, if Jay Billis, the times that he does criticize us, there's usually a reason behind it. There's other analysts, the same thing, like, where you see there's details and there's reasons, and they're probably the same ones that we pointed out too. Like, when you see something like this, where it's just that lazy BS, like, and you see it from all, like, the kind of college basketball hot take artists, so it's weird that, you know, a non-college basketball person would then take them on. You see those SU fans come in because I think a lot of SU fans are pretty realistic about this team on a year-to-year basis. There's always going to be your fringe that, you know, say, this team sucks, go man-to-man. Or on the other extreme, this team going to the Final Four, like, they just got screwed by the refs. Like, there's a balance in the middle. I think that's most of the fan base. And for some reason, there's a lot of people that have allowed the extremes to kind of color their opinion of it. And then they use that as ammo to just say dumb things that they know are going to get clicks.
Yeah, it's important. It's, like, just so lazy. And there are so many, like, actual criticisms to make of the Syracuse team. We make them pretty much every week. I think you can, like, very easily argue that Syracuse is not a tournament team and probably be right based on, like, the current situation. The strength of the schedule is just, like, that's such an easy, dumb thing to point to. And, like, go look at, like, almost any strength of schedule for a similar team, and right, you're not going to find a huge difference. Like you're,
or even if you want to go,
just so dumb.
If you want to go, like, advanced stats, look at KenPom right now. SU and Virginia are right next to each other in non-conference. Literally, like, right next to each other in terms of non-conference strength of schedule. Like, you can't sit here and, like, if you're that person, you can't sit here and tell me, you know, that SU schedules poorly, but then also praise Virginia or not take Virginia to task for the same thing.
Right, and no one does, because Virginia just doesn't have that weird, like, stigma around them, and for fair reason. Like, it's not like anyone scheduling these ridiculous non-conferences unless they're small schools that need to do it to try to build up, like, you know, you have those schools that, like, end up with, like, 15 wins, but then you look and they have this stretch where they play, like, four giant powers in a row. Those schools happen, but, like, for power conference teams, no, home games are too valuable. Like, especially if you're selling out your arena or you're coming close or you're, you know, in a Syracuse situation where you're going to put in, like, 15,000 people minimum a night. Like, just having those home games is too valuable. So you're not going to sacrifice it for, like, a road game at, you know, San Diego State. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. So it's just dumb. And if you have any idea of how college basketball works on both, like, a level in terms of just general scheduling, and then you take into account the context of what Syracuse deals with as an athletic department in terms of what the football program is and what the basketball program is, like, it's just so stupid to criticize how SU schedules, especially because I don't think any of these tournament misses in recent years. Definitely not the one that we were not allowed to play in, and then last year's was because we couldn't win a road game to save our lives. So it wasn't because we didn't have enough good non-conference teams. So it's just a dumb criticism when non-conference scheduling has literally never cost us a tournament bid. Not never. Had,
well,
not cost us a tournament bid.
Even 06-07, it didn't. Like, I mean, last year, all we had to do was just get our shit done. In 06-07, if we just picked up one more quality win, like, home or away, like, then we would have been in. Like, yeah, you're completely right that criticism is just so incredibly lazy, and it's just so dated at this point. I know this kind of presents another good segue into, I don't know if you got to read Hoya Sucks's Projecting Syracuse's NCAA Tournament Team Sheet article today, but for those that didn't, it's very good. Matt goes into a really nice kind of diatribe both about what's wrong and where Syracuse stands. And how, you know, the whole system is messed up in terms of, you know, it's tasking non-basketball analysts to analyze basketball with flawed metrics in a way they just simply can't physically, and it's not their fault. It doesn't mean that they're terrible people for it. It just means that the system is broken. So it's a dual part read, I would say, but I think both of those parts function very well on their own, and I very much enjoyed it. I think a lot of other people that have read it so far seem to have as well. So again, it's a not shameless plug, it's just a plug. Good stuff as always from the from some of the other folks that write for the site, including Suxa, who happens to be probably one of the better bracketologists that I know personally. And I do know two. So.
Yeah, I haven't read the full piece. I saw like what he was doing on Twitter that kind of led to it. I'm now just opening it. But overall, like, he's been on the RPI is a dumb metric train for a while, and he is correct, because RPI is a dumb metric. But overall, like, the whole Quadra thing, I do, while it's still RPI-based, and RPI is just not a very good stat, I kind of appreciate that we have more of an idea of what's being looked at now. I think that's kind of helpful in terms of, like, just the whole argument going down the stretch here. Like, we'll be able to map out, like, this is what the committee is looking at. And obviously, these goalposts change all the time, and, like, they could say, oh, this was absolutely the important thing after the fact, after we get left out or get put in. But it's nice to have this with us as a kind of a guiding tool, whether or not it is the best possible math that we could be using, which, spoiler alert, it is not.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of got into this in the Slack room where I said, like, you know, if you're a really smart team and you're looking to kind of steal a bid, one way to do that is to operate on the fringes, if you want to just mess with the math, is wait to see who Kansas and Kentucky and Duke and North Carolina and a couple other schools schedule in their non-conference, the teams you know you're going to beat, and then schedule them. Because what that does is, while it doesn't affect your win-loss anymore, and it doesn't affect that team's either, they're going to be picking up more losses, it does affect the other part of the RPI, which is the win-loss metric of teams that they faced. So if you schedule the teams that all the best teams schedule, you're still going to get an RPI boost.
Yeah, and a team that could, that, you know, might have been ranked, I don't know how dramatic it could be from one or two games, but a team that might have been ranked, like, you know, in the low 200s to end up in, like, the mid 200s, and it just, like, games it a little bit. Now, I always go with the argument of Syracuse should not be in a position where the RPI is a huge factor in terms of getting in. We should just have the resume to get in no matter what.
Agreed.
That hasn't been the case in the last 3 years. So, you know, you'll take them where you can. Luckily, this year, and Syracuse in general, I feel like in the last couple years, we've done a pretty good job of avoiding, like, the big, like, 300-plus RPI drains, and we've gotten lucky with some of the ones that we've scheduled, like Buffalo this year, and even the Bonnies. Like, it's not good to lose to them, but, like, you'd rather lose to a team that's going to end up as, like, a, you know, probably, are they quad? I guess they would be quadrant one if we had won, but they're quadrant two because we lost. But they're going to be, like, a pretty solid a tournament team if they win their tournament for sure, but, like, they'll probably be, like, an 11 or 12 seed. Yeah. Maybe 13 if they make the tournament. So you like to get into, you know, where those losses look, or those wins look decent versus, like, oh, you know, the Colgate games, like the one every year where it's gonna drop us a lot, and I get keeping that series for local reasons, but you don't want, like, you know, four or five of those games when there's, like, no connection to those schools, and I feel like we used to have more of those.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of see a drop off with schools like Canisius and Niagara, schools like that we really used to play a lot more, and now we definitely do not, and we probably will play even less, you know, once we get to, you know, the 20-game ACC schedule. I think we'll see a big, big change there.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I think you start to have to work this system in your advantage as much as you can, and when you're a Syracuse, you're going to be able to bring in most schools that you reach out to, I feel like. I don't know how often SU's being turned down by any school that's not, like, it's not, like, a crazy trip for it, because a lot of these programs, you know, A, it's probably a pretty decent payday, and B, like, the chance to play in a place like the Carrier Dome, it's a good experience. Syracuse is usually good for their resumes as well.
If you want dome shooting experience.
Yeah, for sure. Overall, I think it's always beneficial to play those teams because, you know, it's not like SU loses to them all that often recently anyway. So if you're going to, you know, might as well pad the RPI where you can, as long as this is a metric that we are using.
Agreed. One more thing before halftime, obviously. Wednesday should be today. NC State heads up to the Carrier Dome. Pretty rude of them on Valentine's Day to schedule a game for 9 p.m. local. Just all around, just why? Especially also noticed on the ACC Network local affiliate list, this game is available in Idaho, but not in California. Doesn't really make any sense, but whatever. That's why we need a linear network and some other things.
We really need a linear network after this year because, man, trying to watch games on the ACC Network Extra when you are a cable cutter and every game is on WLNY is so difficult. I went to a bar on Sunday, which I was able to do. But, like, the other day, I was one of the other Wednesday games that was on Network Extra, I went to a bar here in Hoboken where our office is, and I was like, oh, I assume you guys did WLNY? And no, because it's in Jersey, so they don't get it. So I had to go to the city, and the place I went didn't get it, so it was just like, all right, well, I guess I can't see this game, because it's just like, just get the ACC Network launch, please. Like, that's all I want. It's been, I've missed so many games, and I've had to go, like, watch after the fact, or like just kind of like skim through just to get caught up to like know what I'm talking about, that it's really frustrating. And it's so much worse this year than it used to be, because like at least before, like, you know, you might miss one or two, but like most of them would be on like YES or
yeah, they RSN something else that most you have access of them
to. Yeah, or RSN, so it would be some on some local channel. Now they're all on LNY, and it's just like impossible to get most of them if you're in cable, because you're blocked out on watch ESPN. So very frustrating this year, hopefully. And it doesn't help that the team hasn't been very good. That would have solved a lot of things. I assume we won't have as much an issue. I know we have CBS for Miami, and we have ESPN for UNC, and I bet we'll probably get ESPN or two for Duke. So hopefully it won't be as much of an issue going forward.
Still, once again, it's still aggravating, though.
The state. Yeah, very aggravating, yeah. Just like I cared about watching a lot of these games.
Well, and at least you had, like, I mean, obviously, like, for you, being a cord cutter, like, not so much, but, like, if you weren't a cord cutter, you would have had local access to pretty much all these games. For me, like, you know, I'm dealing with, like, some of these games are available in San Francisco only. Some of them aren't available in California at all. Some of the bigger ones are available in L.A., that, you know, the non-ESPN and CBS ones. But, like, yeah, I did feel it was a much, much bigger issue, and that the ACC Network solution wasn't really much of a solution this year, and I feel like it created a lot more aggravation than it was worth kind of departing from the RSN setup the way they had. Definitely not going to give them the type of data they probably want either in terms of who's watching these games, because I'm sure that helps kind of dictate some of these decisions. I feel like they weren't necessarily ready for the problems that, you know, this many streaming games could lead to, this much kind of variance from game to game. Obviously, again, doesn't matter much in New York, where every game was going to be available on a local affiliate if you had, you know, linear TV. But for those outside of the local markets, you kind of leave these things up to like a pretty big gamble that happened during football season and happened quite a bit during basketball season this year. So we got another year of this before we actually, is this? No, we still have one more year, right? Does it launch 2019? Or does it launch this fall?
I don't think it's this fall. I think it's 2019, but they've changed, like, everything's changed so much with this that I can't even remember.
I think it's 2019.
Yeah, that sounds right. I don't think they would launch. I think we would know if they were launching before this fall. I'm pretty sure it's 2019.
Yeah, so that'll be another fun year of ACC Network Extra Bingo.
Yep. At least I will say, the one thing I will say, the one kind of saving grace, and it's not really saving grace because it doesn't change if you can watch the games or not, but SU's been a lot better about letting you know where these games are being broadcast locally, which was never a strong suit of theirs before.
No. I'm sure they were just tired of all the angry tweets about where's the game. Those finally shifted from us and Brent X to the Syracuse feed.
Yes. I'm sure Brent's like Twitter engagement's way down, though.
Yeah, and yeah, I gotta keep that score up. again, before we hit halftime, I want to talk NC State a little bit. NC State and us are kind of in similar situations. At the same time, though, like NC State, 16-9, 6-6 overall, they do actually have some bad losses, which is not something that Syracuse can say. I don't know where UNI's RPI is, but I'm sure it's not great. UNC Greensboro, same deal. Those two probably going to cause some problems to an extent, and they won't cancel out, you know, wins over North Carolina and Duke, but they probably don't help, depending on whether or not the committee emphasizes losses or wins. NC State also has a pretty, not super manageable slate to end, but a much more manageable slate than we do. They have road game at us, road game at Wake Forest, and then they're hosting BC and Florida State. They're on the road at Georgia Tech, and they're against Louisville. They could realistically, even without being that good of a team, go 5-1 in there.
Yeah, I still don't know how good they are. I think everyone was kind of buying really hard on them after they beat UNC, but then like they beat Notre Dame, which was nice. Like they beat them by 18, but Notre Dame's been terrible, and it's embarrassing that we lost to them. But they've been like Notre Dame has not recovered from all the injuries they have. And then before that, they beat Pitt by 4, which is like almost a loss. and then since obviously they dropped 2 to Va Tech and UNC. Which neither was like a terrible loss, but it's just not like, you know, it seems like the hype for NC State after the UNC win is kind of subdued. And those two early bad losses probably won't, I mean, they're not going to look great. I think that they might, if they finish strong, I feel like they are going to get the benefit of the doubt compared to those, the Greensboro and the UNI loss because, you know, new coach and they're, you know, kind of finding their way. It is going to be a pretty interesting comparison if we are kind of battling it out for a seat with them. Obviously, the head-to-head will be huge.
You would think.
As we've said, like, three weeks in a row now, look at the Wake Forest head-to-head with us last year. Doesn't always mean, you know, everything. But they have, you know, oh, they also won over Clemson, which is nice. And Duke.
Yeah, three big wins.
Yes. I forgot they had those two back-to-back after they lost to ND by, like, a ton, by, like, 30. And then before they got brought back to the real world by UVA. So they're definitely going to have, like, the higher highs than us, assuming we don't go on a tear. They're probably going to have the lower lows because they have those two really bad losses. I think they're probably helped by, as I said, the fact that they are, you know, potentially going to finish strong and have those top-heavy wins. And the wins seem to be meaning more than the losses so far based on what we've seen from the committee so early on. So it'll be an interesting case, but, you know, you could also see NC State, you know, on the other hand, if they lose to us, none of those games is like a cakewalk. Like, yeah. Even BC and Georgia Tech could, like, pick you off, so, or Wake, as we just saw. So there are a lot of these ACCs is super interesting in the middle here. A run of teams that are between, like, 7-5 and 6-7 in conference. Are all going to be in the hunt down the stretch here. And this is a huge game. I mean, every game for SU is going to be big down as we finish up because there just aren't – there's no team aside from Pitt, who we already, you know, handled, that you're going to look at and say, oh, there's no way Syracuse loses this.
Right. I mean, and yeah, for NC State, it's the same thing, but to a different extent, obviously, because none of these teams are ranked. Still all of them are talented. I think – they probably end up somewhere in the 10-8, 9-9 range. And if they finish 10-8, I feel like they just need a win in the ACC tournament and they'll be in. Again, despite those losses. But that's a conversation for kind of down the road. Dan, this team presents some problems. Particularly, they're a good three-point shooting team. They have three different players who shoot better than 34% from the field. They also have... you know, several quality big men, Omer Yurtseven and Torin Dorn, who I just like saying his name. It's kind of fun. Looking at those guys, like, this seems like a matchup problem, but like you said, we really don't know how good or not this team is when they play so, like, kind of hot and cold. I mean, they also don't play defense, as evidenced by their recent game against UNC when they allowed the Heels to shoot like 56% from the floor.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting matchup for us because we've been less dominant in terms of our rebounding and our interior play as of late. Part of that's depth, obviously, and they do have a lot of size as NC State tends to. They do have a couple decent shooters, like you said, and even their bigs can kind of step out a bit. Yurtseven, you know, hasn't taken a ton of threes, but he's knocked down almost half of them. But, you know, Freeman, Beverly, and then some of the guys down the bench, even Markel Johnson is their best shooter by percentages. He hasn't taken a ton. Actually, Yurtseven technically is, but Johnson's over 43%. Sam Hunt, who plays about 15 minutes a game, to knock him down at 34%. So
I got him as the Riley Ferguson Memorial Player of the Game right now.
Sam Hunt?
Yep.
That's who I was looking at. I would like started to Google him as I was looking down the roster here. He definitely profiles.
Terrifying.
yeah, he'll probably play. So he averages 15 minutes a game. I'd say he's going to play 28 minutes. I'm going to say he scores 17 points. And I don't know. Dude, so my only concern here is he's actually a transfer from NCAA&T. I feel like these usually aren't grad transfers, but I feel like they're, you know, you can always have exceptions here.
He went 7 of 11 against Jacksonville.
Ooh, yeah, so he could definitely, I mean, that almost counts against him a little bit because he's had a big game, but Jacksonville's Jacksonville, so it's not like a...
He only played 20 minutes in that one.
That's crazy. He had 20 points in 20 minutes.
But then he also was like 3 of 12, I think, against Georgia Tech or another team. So like he's had... Pitt. Oh, Pitt. So like he's had some
all
good games.
All from 3.
Yeah, all from 3. Just that's the thing. Like he's one of those terrifying, like I'm going to play 15 minutes a game and I'm just going to let it fly for all 15 minutes. And like we don't have... I don't think we have the energy to like get out there with it. Like Brissett isn't a terrible defender, but I don't think... Like, he's not your typical player in that role that we have that can, like, jump out and defend the perimeter the same way we've had, like, more athletic kind of 3-4 flex guys.
Yeah, I kind of want a stat of players in the ACC in terms of three-point attempts per minute.
I bet he'd be pretty high if I had
to. I really want someone to crunch those numbers because that'd be a very entertaining thing to look at.
This is where we need an intern because I'm not doing it. But yeah, if somebody
wants
I
definitely don't have time. No, that's definitely not me.
If somebody wants to get on that.
Yeah, I want someone else to do this work. Come on. Someone who has, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard if you have access to like an Excel spreadsheet of just the ACC stats.
Yeah, like that's the thing. If it was in one place, I would do it in a second. Like it really wouldn't take very long. But because these things are not in one place, it would be a little bit of a chore. Dan, given that kind of matchup issue and the, you know, mentioning the bigs, what do you see happening in this one? Because I'm torn here. Not torn Dorn, but just torn about what's going to happen. I feel like this could be a letdown spot after kind of hinting at one against Wake Forest for Syracuse, but NC State also has shown themselves to be a little bit vulnerable on the other end. And I feel like when teams can't guard Syracuse, they are significantly better, obviously, than when teams can and do.
Yeah, this is tough because it's on the road. It's a team that we have had like very mixed results against since joining the ACC.
Well, we're at home. They're on the road.
Oh, we are at home. I'm an idiot. I was looking at the NC State page that had. Okay, we are at home. Feel a lot better about that. Very well prepared for this podcast. Yeah, I had the NC State version of the like ESPN home clubhouse page open, and that had an at, which makes sense because NC State is on the road. So we are at home. It's a late start. I'm now changing everything I was about to say. I don't know. I think it's going to be close either way. I think it's going to be super frustrating because it is a Syracuse game. I feel weirdly okay about this one, and I haven't been super confident about any of these games recently. I feel like we have a little bit of momentum on our side. I think Battle is starting to play better after he had that weird slump in the middle of the season. And NC State, obviously, is coming off of two tough losses. We are coming off of two pretty good wins. I'm going to take Syracuse. I don't know if I feel good about taking them, but I'm going to for, like, a narrow win here. I think it'll be another, like, we're going to be, you know, very frustrated and praying this game away. But I'll take Syracuse, but for, like, a six-point late free-throw aided win.
I just feel like NC State took too many notes from the Wake Forest game, and as much as I want to pick Syracuse, I feel like I'm almost, hopefully, reverse jinxing this, and I think NC State's going to win something in, like, the 77, like, 71 range. It's going to be, like, a frustrating end-of-game situation. That might just be because we run out of gas, so it won't be, like, this, this, you know, large-scale, like, damning argument against Syracuse. It'll more just be, this is what happens when you play three of your players 40 minutes a game, every game. Yeah, I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, we actually flipped, you've been the more optimistic one in our, like, predictions for these games the last couple of weeks, so we're flipping a little bit.
I'm actually the most accurate member of the Noon Magician staff this year.
Okay.
I know Bobby tabulated those results and tweeted them out like a week ago, and I was I was at the time like 17-4 or something picking games.
Not bad.
I will take it. All right. So why don't we talk a little halftime? Then we can go into some football. Maybe circle back around basketball, depending on what we're in the mood for.
Sounds good.
You drank plenty this weekend, which I am envious of. I did not drink at all because I felt like after vacation and going a little too hard during the Super Bowl, I felt like I needed a little bit of a break.
That's fair. I I will carry this then, because I had a big like out of nowhere drinking weekend. Just had a lot of beery events. So I had I'm gonna try to break these up just like there were like definitive moments here. I went to the same place for a dinner and a brunch, and I can't remember which one I had this at, but I had a juice bomb by Sloop Brewing. I think it was at the dinner, which I've had before. Sloop, a very solid brewery out of Elizaville. And the juice bomb is, like you probably imagine from the name, just a big, juicy IPA, very delicious. I'm going to skip over plenty because I had a lot, so just under with the highlights this week. One of the most unexpected highlights for me was a brewery in New York, and there are so many damn Brooklyn breweries at this point that I don't even know. Like, I feel like I don't know half of them. This is from Five Boroughs, which is in Sunset Park, down by the water. If you're not in New York, you probably don't know it too well, but down in Brooklyn. And that's the first thing I ever had from them, their Last Stop IPA, which was, like, really, really, really hoppy, really flavorful, and yet, like, not overwhelming to the point where, like, you know, it takes you forever to drink one. Like, it was a really, really well-balanced, really well-done IPA. So big fan of that, and I'm going to keep a lookout for them. And then I went to Torst on Sunday because having a launch event for a nomadic brewery based out of Long Island, but it looks like they're just kind of all over the place in terms of where they actually brew, called Root and Branch. So some of the better ones I've had from them were the Powers, Roots, and Radicals. They're mostly IPAs. I had the ICU, which they brewed with Folks Beer.
Love Folks Beer.
Yes. I had Dead Men on Holiday, which I think they absolutely brewed themselves, which is really good. Really, like, there were a couple different beers I had this weekend that were super, like you would have no idea that they were as boozy as they were, and then you look and they're like 8%, and it's kind of unbelievable they are, because they're like very drinkable, and I would have probably paired them at like the 4s or maybe the 5s. I had another brewery that was being featured at Taurus was Hudson Valley, and they specialize in sour IPAs, which was very much in my wheelhouse. Their Babylon was delicious. What else did they have? Their Peach Silhouette was one of the best beers I had this weekend. Another one that was, like, super, super drinkable, and then you looked and it was, like, 8-something percent. For whatever reason, New York City got flooded by Alchemist cans this weekend. I saw it for sale, like, 3 different places, which was bizarre. So they were at a Hetty Topper, but I did a Focal Banger, which I hadn't had before, which is really, really good and super different from Hetty. Just very, very unique, like, hop flavors. Not quite sure what they used in the brew there, but really, really delicious. I had It's Hip to Be Square by Evil Twin, which was good. I had a Brattleberry by Hermit Thrush, which was very good. And then the other Evil Twin I had, since I was a tourist, the IPA Culotta, which is a pina colada-themed IPA with coconut and pineapple, and it's super, super delicious.
Sounds like
it. Yeah, so I think they just put that one out. So those were the highlights. I had a bunch of others, but I had to kind of limit it for this, so you can head over to Untappd, Dan underscore Lyons, and you can see the full arrangement of stuff I was able to have.
We picked the right week for me not to drink, it would appear.
Yeah, we spread it out well.
Yeah, I'll definitely be back on it this weekend. I just feel like my liver deserved a break. Just a brief one, but one nonetheless. So despite the fact that it is not football season, I running a blog about a basketball school mostly, I managed to shove in as much football content as possible. Today, 3 articles, as it would end up. The first one, brief, Rodney Williams will pursue a grad transfer. He is the latest in a line of 4 this offseason. I think now Antoine Cordy might be the only Schaefer recruit left on the roster since, like, I think 7 defensive back. Well, Schaefer recruit, secondary Schaefer recruit left, because I think like 7 or so have left the program in the last 2 off seasons, Dan. I think that's more of a fit thing, though.
Yeah. Williams is a little surprising.
He could have even started, potentially.
Yeah, and I didn't see a lot of, like, you know, you kind of get you see the rumors about these guys before it happens. It kind of took me by surprise today when I saw it come through on Twitter.
Yeah, because, like, I just saw, what was it, last week? I think, like, Tommy DeVito, like, tweeted that, it like, Rodney had, like, a new Twitter feed or something. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
That sounds right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't follow these guys. I just, other people like tweet them. I just have a very strict rule about not following current college players or high school kids. Just because I know what I tweeted as a college kid and what I would have tweeted as a high school kid. And I don't want to see that. So.
Yep. I definitely culled my Twitter feed pretty well, like a couple of years out of college.
It's for the best. But yeah, I think Rodney leaving kind of opens up an interesting conversation about the secondary. We're going to see some youth back there again, but maybe it's youth that is a little bit better of a fit for the Tampa 2.
Yeah, it's I will say, like, losing a defensive back is probably a little less dramatic than, like, if he was along the defensive line where we've had so many depth issues. Obviously, I think we would have preferred to still have him because he, you know, was a very solid player for us for a long time. But, you know, it's hard to fault people. But he would have been a potential starter at safety. And now I think you could go in a lot of different directions at that position.
Yeah, I mean, with Foster, Clark, some of the freshmen, like, you know, maybe Dre Sisco gets a look. It's going to be weird. I think the spring is only going to start to kind of scratch the surface of where we could go. You know, safety, you have to assume Cordy has one of the spots locked down. So then again, it's just a question of, you know, who gets that other one. That could be critical. I feel like last year safety was a trouble spot yet again. Cordy went down in game one, which was heartbreaking for him, especially as a kid who missed almost all of the 2016 season. And then once Jordan Martin went down after switching to safety about five games in, you saw a precipitous kind of, you know, downturn in terms of production back there. I mean, obviously the guys out there tried, but, you know, that secondary was really challenged in the second half of the year, and it showed. And I think the breaking point was that Wake Forest game when everything just kind of, you know, came crashing down and never really recovered.
Yeah, and defensive back has been kind of an issue for a while here. I mean, you cited, like, the issues we had under Schaefer, but it's probably been – things got better this fall, but it's been, like, a major weak spot for this team for years.
The post-Shamarco days?
Yeah, the post-Shamarco – and even those days, like, there were strengths. They weren't, like, great cover groups, and the strengths were kind of helped by the fact that we had a pretty good pass rush and we've had very good linebackers for a long time now. But overall, I think there's definitely more to be optimistic about. I think we brought in, obviously, our number one in this class is Trill Williams. He'll probably end up playing corner. So I think Williams would have been a nice player to have. He definitely did some good things in the box, especially. I don't think he was, like, a great downfield defender. But, yeah, you don't like to lose depth, but you wish these guys the best as they make these kind of changes.
Totally. And I mean, who knows? He could end up at Middle Tennessee. That seems like Middle Tennessee and Western Michigan. Western Michigan might get a block this time around.
Probably considering we play them.
Yeah. Middle Tennessee, I don't think we'll ever be playing them again, at least as long as Scott Schaefer's there.
Can we not?
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt. Who was it that ended up there already? Was it Cordell Hudson? Or was it somebody else? One of them ended up. Maybe it was Davon Ellison. One of the guys that left. One of the guys that left this offseason already ended up at Middle Tennessee.
I tried to Google it, and I'm just getting, like, the actual, like, how to transfer to Middle Tennessee as a student. So that's not super.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Like,
Cordell Hudson.
It was Cordell Hudson. Boom. All right. So yeah, he might end up Middle Tennessee. He might end up somewhere else. Who knows? Either way, we wish Rodney the best. He got to play for each of the last 4 years, but got hurt early in 2014, so he was able to medical redshirt. Good for him that he's able to get another opportunity out there. Some other Syracuse news before we get to kind of the quarterback conversation. Syracuse scheduled Ohio, kind of an undercover announcement today. Wasn't announced by the school, FB Schedules, the expert in all things scheduling, does a really good job of throwing FOIA requests out there. Which I commend them for. It makes my job easier because I don't have to do it. As everyone knows, you can't really do a FOIA request on Syracuse, but you can on all the other state schools that play football. And that includes the University of Ohio, who we will now be playing and hosting in 2022 for a whopping $850,000 for a one-off game, which not really thrilled about that, but whatever.
Yeah, that's a lot. I don't know I feel like the going rate hasn't been that high, so
no.
I'm a little surprised that we're paying that much, but
especially this far out. I think we paid close to $1 million for Middle Tennessee for a one-off, which blows because we lost. But we
also a shorter turnaround.
Yeah, much shorter turnaround, and I think that's why it was like that. Ohio, we're scheduling them pretty far out, so I'm a little confused as to why it was that much money. A and B, why we didn't just do a home and home.
Yeah, I will say I don't mind the Ohio. It seems like it's a one-off for now. I don't know if something could change with that, but overall, like, I think it's pretty unlikely that Frank Solich is still there.
Yeah.
And he's been incredible since he got to Ohio. He's been there for a while now. And they've been one of the more consistent MAC programs and one of the more dangerous ones. Granted, like, the big teams they've beaten are, like, Kansas a couple times, I feel like.
Yeah.
So that's not, you know, anything to go crazy over. But there's a decent chance that they are a program in a bit of a transition, even though he'll probably leave before 2022. So I don't think we'll catch him like the year they're changing coaches. But odds are it won't be the same Ohio program that's been so consistent the last couple of years.
And even if it is, we should be better.
One would hope.
One would hope. I mean, it's the same thing when people were saying, like, when I was complaining a little bit about Rutgers, it was more like, hey, like, if we're this concerned about Rutgers, like, then chances are this entire coaching staff has been turned over, like, if we're that concerned by 2020. And, you know, I agree with that to an extent. I'm never against scheduling advantageously in areas that we recruit to, Ohio being one of them. You know, the directional Michigans are fine in that regard as well. Any of the, you know, G5 schools in Virginia, North Carolina, where we do play once a year, but nonetheless, good to get out to some of the other areas around there. Georgia, where we only go once every 12 years. So yeah, I'll take the Ohio matchup. I'll take just getting teams on the schedule. This is only the second team on the 2022 schedule, Notre Dame being the other. Other people pointed out too that this should guarantee that we're playing seven home games for 2022. Unless something changes wildly, like us deciding that we're gonna schedule two road games, which I don't know why we would.
Yeah, and if you can get like a one for nothing, obviously we're paying a bit for it. I don't know when those payments actually go out, so there's a chance we've just kind of projected forward and said like, oh, this is what this will probably cost in 2022, versus just these prices for like college football in general. Like everything's just becoming way more expensive very quickly in terms of like coaching. Salaries and everything else, like everything's getting super inflated. So there's a chance that like by the time that rolls around, assuming payments aren't cleared like tomorrow, and based on like the whole Arkansas State Miami drama, I don't think that's the case. There's a chance that that's like actually pretty decent market value by the time this game is actually played.
Yeah, maybe. So yeah, another weird thing before we move on to the next football topic. Haven't played them since 1921. Which I thought is weird, considering where Ohio is and where we are and all that.
A little bit. I feel like we play all these MAC teams, like, once in a while.
Yeah, like regularly.
Have, like, series with them. So that is weird. I mean, Ohio is, like, kind of a unique school. It's not like this, you know, I feel like it's a slightly different profile than a lot of these other MAC schools, but it is strange that, like, that we haven't played since then because, you know, you generally, we schedule the MAC a lot. And we've played, like, Miami of Ohio, we haven't played Kent State. We played Akron. We have Western Michigan coming up. We played Central Michigan a bunch. Like, it is strange that they haven't been on that list since, you know, the 20s. You think it would have happened once or twice.
Yeah, Ohio's actually never scored a point on us. And maybe we keep that streak going.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, they SU won 38-0 in the most recent matchup and 73-0 in the matchup before that. So, yeah, if SU wants to keep that streak going, feel free.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm struggling to get overly excited about a game that's a mid-major game that's 4 years away. But overall, I think there are definitely worse games you could have put on the schedule. And it's nice that we're already getting a jump on this. I mean, we spent so long complaining about scheduling with Syracuse, and now like it really does seem like we've kind of figured it out. Everything that's happened recently has been pretty good.
Still got five openings though between 2020 and 2022.
Yeah, but we're like way ahead of like the pace we used to be. We're like heading into a season we would have a game.
Yeah, like 2019 is already done. That's the most stunning part to me. Like, we don't have to worry about next season. That's already finished. But 2020's only got two done, so let's get on that. Anyway, before I start going down that rabbit hole, also talked about, and I was surprised how many comments this article got, spring football preview. Started doing my annual kind of position by position. This time around, started with quarterbacks, as per usual. Dungy's the starter, but there's some people that think that DeVito, and I should have expected this, some people thinking that DeVito should potentially be given the reins and definitely has a leg up on Culpepper. I'm not sure about, well, I disagree fervently with the first part. Second one, I don't necessarily think he's a leg up on Culpepper yet, but he could by the end of the summer.
Yeah, I think the second one's not unfair. I think the first one's just like, let's calm down. Yeah, like, Aaron Dungy's very, very good. And like the one issue with Dungy has been his health, and if he stays healthy, then I don't know why we're, you know, kicking him off out of the, you know, being a starter here. So I hope that we put ourselves in a position to play a couple different quarterbacks. Like, it was nice to get Culpepper some run this year, and we're all very excited for Tommy DeVito. But like, let's chill a bit. Like, Dungy's very, very good. And if he's healthy, he is going to be the starter, unless DeVito is just like so next level that it's not even a question. So. I feel very, very confident that barring injury, Dungy will be the starter.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. But I think it's all barring injury. I think that's the only way you see DeVito. And, like, I mean, see DeVito is in, like, starting a game. Hopefully, yeah, we you know, grab some big leads and are able to play DeVito and or Culpepper, you know, to close out a couple contests this year, one way or the other. But... I'm looking forward to a season, hopefully, where Dungy runs a little bit less, throws a little bit more, and throws a little bit more accurately. We saw a dip there for him last year, which I think is something to watch out for, especially when we have a much younger receiving core this year that could potentially impact it even more. I think if Dungy is looking more like a, you know, 55 to 60% accuracy guy, that could have some real negative effects. Obviously, not to put it all on him. That could have some real negative effects versus being somewhere in the, you know, 61 to 65% range where he was in his first season in Dino Babers' system, where I felt like he was a little bit more efficient throwing the ball than he was this past season.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think hopefully it'll just be nice to have a full season of Dungy playing end-to-end. Obviously, we always bring it up, like, it wasn't concussions or head injuries or whatever. This year it was a leg injury, and he seems to have recovered from that. But it would just really, really be nice to finally see him put together like a full 12 games.
Yeah, and I mean, so I think part of that is not running, especially up the middle. If we can get a better push in the offensive line, I think we will, especially with Aaron Roberts back. That's ideal. I think if Chris Elmore can emerge as a legitimate short yardage threat, and I think he was on the way to being one last year, but I don't think he really accomplished that yet. That'd be great. I think if we can get someone like Mackenzie Pierre potentially to be our short yardage option more regularly, that's another one. Like, anything we can do to make Dungy not the short yardage quarterback, that's great for one. I'd like to see, I know I mentioned in the article, I'd like to see him down around, you know, maybe 80 to 90 carries on the year. I think that is a nice compromise that allows him to still use his speed and make some plays and keep himself a threat to run the football without, while still, you know, keeping him safe and not necessarily predicating the entire run game on him. That's really been kind of problematic in recent years, as we've seen it uptick each year. He went from, I think it was something around 80 to 90 carries his freshman year to something around, I think, 110 to 120 his sophomore year, and then last year, 143 carries. I don't know. I just feel like that's not really it's not really ideal, and it's not really much of an offense, especially when you know that a bunch of these, they're either called runs that seem silly at the time, they're up the gut, or they're improvised runs that, you know, Dungy does plenty of those. And you want that improvisation, but maybe you can't have the 10 to 15 called runs and the improvisation. It has to be one or the other.
Yeah, I agree. And the sheer amount of improvisational runs you have from Dungy kind of make their effect, like, lesser.
Right.
So, like, I love when he breaks, like, a, you know, a 15-yard scramble, but if that's, like, such a core of the offense, it stops becoming a surprise, and it's something that the defense can gear in on, and then he's, you know, susceptible to more hits, and as we talked about, like, you just, ideally, you know, it's always fun to have these quarterbacks who can get out and do a lot of things, but, like, ideally you want your quarterback taking as few hits as possible, and to this point, that hasn't really been possible based on Dungy's style, but you hope that, you know, this is finally the year with a hopefully healthy an improved offensive line and hopefully an improved running game, all these things that can kind of help him just play the position more cleanly, that's something that we can accomplish this season.
Yeah, I would love that. One last thing on Dungeigas before we go. Young receivers. I know it was something I mentioned earlier. Steve Ishmael and Irv Phillips are gone. Devin Butler, Sean Riley, Ravian Pierce, three of the names you'll probably be seeing a lot, at least in spring practice. There'll be plenty more. A lot of the young guys, you know, Cameron Jordan, Russell Thompson Bishop, Ed Hendricks, you know, some of the other new guys. Like, there's plenty of younger names that could really rise up here, but I think at least initially you're going to see Syracuse be leaning on guys like Riley and Butler and Pierce, the tight end. Pierce could actually end up having a pretty nice season this year, I think. If we can just block better for Dungy, that should free him up to be, you know, out kind of in space. And we could see kind of the inside receiver role transition a little bit more to a bigger target like him while using Riley, Riley's speed to kind of create some mismatches with linebackers a little bit further down the field. But I do think that in general, Dungy being there is going to help guys like Riley and Butler come along. I think it's going to help, you know, again, guys like Jordan, Thompson Bishop, plenty of the others, you know, Sherrod, Nikeem Johnson, like all these guys are going to benefit from having Dungy there in his final season, his third year in the offense. These guys are just, they need a little bit more time, and I'd rather have them have a ton of experience. Now, you and I have talked about this a ton, Dan. These guys having a ton of experience before kind of the reins get handed off to either Culpepper or DeVito, and you know, those guys stepping in with a very experienced offensive line in front of them and some very experienced receivers around them.
Yeah, I think overall there's just a lot to look forward to. I think this has a chance to hopefully be finally be the balanced offense that we've been looking for under Babers, and unfortunately because of the roster and injuries especially, we've kind of done the best with what we've had, but we haven't had like a super efficient group. And we keep on like going back to what we saw from Babers, you know, last stops, and you had this very balanced, if not like slightly run oriented group with, you know, that also put up huge passing numbers because they were able to get chunk plays. And hopefully we can start to kind of shift more towards that, by, you know, we don't need this crazy running game, but just being able to like consistently get over 4 yards of carry would be a huge upgrade. And I think on paper, this should be a year where we can start to kind of make those moves. And we you know, we've learned about guys like Mo Neal and even, you know, Strickland, who hasn't been great on the ground but has his own strengths. Like, we hopefully Babers has kind of had a couple big years here to understand his roster and really get in kind of a groove of what people can do well and what they can't, and we can move more towards what we know the Babers offense to be when it's really firing on all cylinders.
Agreed. Yeah, let's get a more balanced offense. I would very much appreciate it. But yeah, we'll talk more about running backs probably next week, because I know I'll definitely have my running backs preview. That'll be interesting because there'll be no real turnover. It's just a question of who's really going to carry the ball. There's a lot of options now. But yeah, that's more fodder for next week, I guess. Dan, anything else before we go? Obviously, again, very exciting / stressful game against NC State on Wednesday night.
They all are.
This is also true.
Just an easy game that I don't like freak out about in the last 2 minutes would be nice.
Yeah, I sign me up for that. And by don't freak out, I mean, like, let me actually be just comfortably winning instead of not freaking out because I've accepted fate.
Yeah, that too. I guess I prefer the freak out to, like, just outwardly losing. But, man, the way it came was just a lot. Especially because it finally looked like we had, like, a nice Sunday afternoon just to enjoy the basketball. And then that crazy couple minutes was too much.
Yeah. SU, please make this easy. Anyway, Dan, thank you as always for joining.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for hosting, and enjoy your Valentine's Day tomorrow.
Thank you very much, sir. You as well. Whatever those plans entail.
Watching basketball.
All right, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Detroit Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange.
Go Orange.